Okay. Thanks, Jonathan and Ken. Ken, isn't Thanksgiving in October, though?
Yeah, if you're Canadian, yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, so Father Duchon, would you like to come up? Father Duchon is works with the Catholic Chaplaincy here at Oxford, and he's also worked taught at the Jesuit boys' school at Wimbledon.
Yes, that's the chaplaincy.
Okay, right. And he will speak for about, I think, 45 minutes or so, and then we'll have a student panel. We'll have a couple students come up and share their experience with guided prayer, and there will be a chance to ask questions then. So that's when we'll sort of do our Q&A. So great.
Start with the prejudice against these microphones, because when I was ordained, I was presented for my first mass with a radio mic, asked to put it on, and it then betrayed me in the middle of the, just as I went up for my homily. So I'm a bit suspicious of them, but hopefully you can hear me and that works. The context of this talk is that each year in the Catholic Chaplaincy, we organise a week of guided prayer in daily life, in which for half an hour, people pray each day, and then they meet with a prayer guide for half an hour over the course of a week, and there are talks about ways of praying. So this is a way of praying that people find very helpful, and therefore I'm sort of basically giving an introduction to the background to this. And in a way, I'd sum this up by saying that this is about how God invites and sets free people who are perhaps caught up in all sorts of different ideas. And the model of this is the person who sort of compiled this way of praying together, called Ignatius of Loyola. He was, as he describes himself, up until his 26th year, he was a man given over to the vanities of the world. And what changed him? So he starts off as a soldier. So you have a sort of an engraving of him as a soldier. Clearly, considering himself to be a very handsome and attractive and important man. And what changed him was that he was, in 1521, in a battle. Now, this is a battle that, sort of, as it were, militarily, is quite unimportant. But I have a question as to whether it might be one of the most significant battles in Western history. Because in this battle, at Pamplona, he was defending the castle, the citadel of Pamplona, against the French. And he was the one person who said, we should keep fighting, we're not going to give in to the French. Some of you might approve of that sentiment. We're not going to give in to the French. And so he encouraged them to defend the castle. But in the middle of that battle, a cannonball passed between his legs. Fairly painful. It shattered one of his legs and seriously damaged the other. At which point, of course, he literally collapsed. And the battle seems to have gone on for another 2 or 3 days. And so on the 24th of May, they surrendered. They gave up and admitted defeat. But Ignatius was there sort of very bravely, sort of gritting his teeth and sort of coping with all of this. And he really impressed the French soldiers. They carried him back on a litter back home. And what happened when he got home was they looked at his leg that they tried to set already, and they found that it wasn't quite straight. That there was a bit of bone sticking, it was sort of sticking out the wrong way, and he was going to have one leg longer than the other, and he was going to be hobbling around. And so what he thought was, that means I will be unattractive to women. And therefore, he insisted that they break the leg again. This is 1521, no anaesthetic. They break the leg again and reset it straight so that he would be beautiful and handsome. And so he suffered this butchery of his leg being reset without any anesthetic, and through all of this pain, he says, he showed no sign of pain apart from a little gritting of the teeth and a little bit of clenching of the fists. So he was at his home, a place called in the north of Spain, about 100 kilometers northwest of Pamplona, at a place called Loyola in Aspeitia. And this is the sort of crest over the door of his family house, and it shows two wolves eating at the cooking pot, and it symbolizes the fact that the Loyola family were considered to be so generous to everybody about that even the wolves were able to eat from their cooking pot. And that's a hallmark of everything about this man and throughout his life, even in once he turns his life to God, that's a characteristic. Now, as he was recovering from his surgery, he nearly died, but he is recovering and he's bored. It takes a long time for a leg to set. I'm sure the medics among us can confirm this. And he's saying, well, what can I do? And he wants something to read. And what he wants to read is what he's used to reading, which is this book of tales of chivalry, Amadis de Gaulle, rather improbable accounts of different adventures. I'm not going to read it to you because I only just found this book the other week and it's in Spanish, so it would require instant translation, so you won't hear that. But instead, what he was given was something quite different. I've hidden it in my bag. He was given this to read. Two volumes, these two volumes of The Life of Christ by a German Carthusian monk, commenting on different passages of The Life of Christ at great length. Now, being a Jesuit, having heard of this writer, I was thinking, oh, it'd be really interesting to get hold of these books, and I found them on whatever, Alibris or whatever, and started reading them, thinking, oh, this would be really useful. Well, it really, I mean, it is, some of it is very interesting, but it's actually quite tedious to go through it. It's much easier to read the Gospel. And the other thing that he was given was this, a book called The Golden Legend, which is a life, and I think it's what gives us the common understanding of the word legend. It's legend really means things to be read. What is to be read? They're the lives of the saints, arranged according to their saints' days in the year. And he tells the story of different saints. And this is a Dominican from the 14th century. He had compiled these. And this isn't really what Ignatius wanted to read. What he wanted to read was these exciting tales of chivalry and of romance and so on. And instead he stuck there reading these lives of how people fasted and walked barefoot to Jerusalem and so on. And what he finds really surprising is that as he reads these stories, as he lies there in his bed reading these stories, he thinks about himself, imagines himself as this pilgrim doing penances, extravagant, extreme penances of the sort which, when students come to me and say, I was thinking of doing this, I say, no, you mustn't. That really isn't not going to help you at all. They're really extravagant. And so he's dwelling on these things that he's reading. And then as he reads, he also thinks of the sort of thing that he would normally like to do. So he imagines courting a great lady. Now, we don't exactly know who this was, but the three names that I've read, I think all married members of royal families, sort of like queens and empresses, of great nobility. And he imagines the great things he's going to say, the great things he's going to do for them, and to them, to impress them. And he alternates between these two ideas of being a pilgrim and courting this great lady, doing great deeds of chivalry in the way that he was already used to doing. And this is a key moment for him, because what he notices is that when he's thinking about the great deeds of chivalry, these great acts of poetry that he's going to write, these great acts of sort of romance that he's going to do, that he feels great, he really enjoys it, but it fizzles away very quickly when he stops thinking about it. And to some extent, it leaves him sort of feeling a bit dry and dejected and unhappy because he's not doing those things. And even more surprisingly, when he thinks of these extravagant penances, of the sort which would not be recommended nowadays, he finds great pleasure in doing them, and that the delight, the joy he experiences keeps going. And he dwells on that joy for a long time. And this is a key point, that he notices this, what he feels in response to his reading, to his thoughts, to his prayer, can indicate something about what's going on in him. And it takes him a long time to make sense of this. But he lays there in his bed, weighing up these courtly acts of romance to this great lady, or walking barefoot as a pilgrim to Jerusalem, as many saints had already done before him. And he's weighing those up. And he's saying, well, how do I feel? As he sleeps, as he reads, as he eats, he's thinking about this all the time and noticing the different feelings that he has. And what he decides to do is to become a pilgrim. So he goes to, now you might think the nearby shrine, well he is in Loyola, which is near Bilbao in the Basque country. He walks across Spain to near Barcelona, a great monastery called Montserrat, where there is a great statue of the mother of Jesus, a black Madonna that's been found in the hills. And he goes there and he prays for the entire night before the statue of Our Lady and her son, and then offers his sword as an offering and says, now I will be a knight of God, not a knight in the service of the king. We reckon we have this sword still in the Jesuit church in Barcelona. We're not absolutely sure, but we think that's the one. So we've got these things that sort of tie us into the story. And he takes on, instead of the dress of a soldier, the livery of a soldier in the service of the king, he takes on what he described as the livery of Christ. He dressed as a poor beggar. Now, a theme that comes through this story of his life is that he has great enthusiasm, enormous generosity of what he wants to do, but he doesn't always think it through. So he decides the thing that he's going to do and thinks, this is really great, so I'm going to do this. And here is an example, because how does he get hold of the clothes of a beggar? Well, he thinks, I'm going to do something good and kind. I will find a beggar and offer him a swap. I will offer him my beautiful clothes and ask the beggar to give me his clothes, and then I will wear the clothes of a beggar. Sounds really kind. The beggar has got nice, warm, comfortable clothes. But the result is that, of course, the beggar is well known as a beggar. They know, the people around know how he normally dresses. So what happens? Well, the local police arrest him because they think, well, he must have mugged somebody, stolen their clothes, and there he is going around. And they run after Ignatius, and they find him, and they say, we found your clothes. Look, we've got this scoundrel, what he's done to you, and he's, you know, left you with only these rags. And Ignatius then has to explain to him that, no, actually, I gave him the clothes. That was the deal. Let him go. It was a fair deal. there's a certain amount of imprudence in his enthusiasm for what he does. It's not entirely thought through. But while he's at Montserrat, he's pondering on what he's experienced. And one of the things that he learns from Ludolf, the Carthusian, is when he's reading the Gospels, rather than just sort of reading the text, Ludolf encourages people to imagine themselves into the scene. Probably picking this up from Francis of Assisi, building the crib and inviting people to imagine the scene of the Nativity. Ludolf says, imagine the scene with all of your senses. Think of what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you can touch. Go into the scene and see, what can I do for these people? So I see the little baby there, cold in the stable. What do I do? Well, let me find something to keep the baby warm. Well, maybe as Mary is giving birth to the Lord, she needs some hot water. So I will run and go and find some hot water to bring the hot water to help her in giving birth. Well, maybe they need some food. I'll go and do that. And so from Ludolf, he picks up this idea of, I will imagine myself in the scene and then become part of the story. Now, a more contemporary version of this is, I don't know whether you've ever seen the Woody Allen film, The Purple Rose of Cairo. Well, he is sitting there in the cinema, and at a certain point he gets so excited by the film that he gets up, walks towards the screen, and then walks through the screen and enters the scene. It's a black and white film. As soon as he walks through the screen, it all goes into color. There's something similar that Ludolf is suggesting. This is commonly known as, and it's probably easier to say than Ludolfian contemplation, it's known as Ignatian contemplation. It's Ignatius who made it really popular. A lot of what he picked up was also from the Benedictine monks at Montserrat, where he was praying. And as he spent about 9 months in a cave across the valley from Montserrat, a place called Manresa, thinking, pondering what he was being asked to do, and he'd go across the valley, talk to the monks, and ask them various things. He became very aware of all the wrong that he'd done in his life, all the sins that he'd done, and he'd go and confess them again and try and offload them. And eventually this Benedictine helped him sort of cut the knot and understand how this was now in the past. He'd repented of them, he can now move forward, the church had forgiven him, Christ had forgiven him, he was free of it. And as he sat on the steps of the monastery one day, he had a vision. He was thinking of the Trinity. And the problem was that in the prayer book he had, there were prayers to the Trinity. There was a prayer to the Father, there was a prayer to the Son, there was a prayer to the Holy Spirit, but then there was also a fourth prayer to the whole of the Trinity altogether, because you don't want, obviously, we do not want to split up the persons of the Trinity. They are not separate, they are distinct, but they are one. And Ignatius was very troubled by this problem of having four prayers for three persons of the Trinity. And he was pondering, well, trying to understand the Trinity. Now, those of you who are theologians will remember the story of Augustine walking along the sea, trying to understand the Trinity, encountering a child, trying to pour the ocean into a hole. And he says to the child, little child, do you not understand what you're doing? You're stupid. You cannot put the whole of the ocean into this hole. And the child says to him, well, neither can you understand the mysteries of the Trinity. And Augustine understands that this is Christ. Now you might say, but Ignatius is trying to do the same thing. He's trying to understand the Trinity. But instead, he's sort of praying his way into the life of God. And he is given an insight. And the insight he's given is to see, to understand the Trinity, perhaps to hear the Trinity, as three notes of a chord. The three distinct notes, which are all in relation. And it becomes a real central point of Ignatius's understanding and of his love for God is of this great devotion to the Trinity. And what he then decides that he wants, what God is asking him to do, is to do what the saints had done. And what have the saints done? Well, the great saints, the greatest of saints, they'd gone to Jerusalem. And they had been in the places where Jesus was. They'd touched the places, they'd seen the places where he'd eaten, they'd seen the place where he had ascended into heaven, they'd walked around, they'd seen where he suffered, they'd visited the sepulchre, and so on. And that's what he wanted to do, and he wanted to stay there. And this was the closest he could possibly get to being with Jesus, by being in the place where Jesus had lived. So he begs his money and manages to get onto the boat going to Jerusalem. And so he arrives a beggar, somewhat eccentric, somewhat over-enthusiastic, in Jerusalem in, this would have been about 1520s. Situation then wasn't much better then than it is now. The Franciscans, who were in charge of the holy places, sort of looked at this madman and thought, here comes trouble. If we allow this person to stay here, we're going to end up with a riot, war, all sorts of things could go wrong. He's going to just be constantly a nuisance to us all the time. So the Franciscan, the head Franciscan, says to him, go. You're not welcome here. This isn't where you should stay. Go back home. And Ignatius replies to him, appealing to a higher authority. He says, yes, but I have this understanding from God. I am going to do this because God asked for it. And the Franciscan says, perhaps, but I have my authority from the Pope, and the Pope has told me, if you don't do what I say, we can excommunicate you. And then you're cut off from the church, you're cut off from God. So, I think this was actually a useful exercise of authority in this case, because it allowed Ignatius to see, yes, this is my plan, this is my understanding of God, but actually it doesn't fit in, and it's actually problematic to the way that the rest of the Christian community is trying to organize itself and what it's trying to do. And so eventually at that point he says, okay then, I'll go. I accept what you're saying. And so what he does is he goes back to Spain and he starts to study. But at the same time, he's been praying, he's got some certain insights into who God is, he's been taking notes, compiling notes on how he prays, using the different things that he's been offered, and he's started to compile a tiny book. It's about half the thickness of this. Half of this is his life story, his autobiography, which is what I'm telling you. The other half is this book of his manual, his notes on his spiritual experiences and how to do them, called Spiritual Exercises. I do not recommend you read it. The autobiography, there's a very nice French edition here. That's quite fun to read, especially because it has these cartoons that I've been showing you, and they're quite amusing, and I'm hoping that shortly we'll produce a version in English, but we haven't done one with the pictures yet. The spiritual exercise that he compiled is a manual. I describe it as a manual for programming the video. It is not spiritual reading, and people talking about the spiritual exercises. I've done the spiritual exercises, there's the book of the spiritual exercises, it's quite short, I'll go and read it. But you try and read it and it makes no sense whatsoever. It's the manual for the person giving the exercise, the person accompanying somebody in prayer. And so it's a reminder to me, if I'm accompanying you, of how to lead you through prayer. Suggestions that might be helpful to give you, and to measure them out gently. But you need to know the experience in order to know how to tell you all the details. and to tell you at the right moment what it's important to do. So Ignatius has been compiling all of these things as he goes along, and so as he's going and studying in different places, in Salamanca, in Valladolid, he's going around and he's starting to meet people, and he talks to them, he starts to talk to them about their spiritual life and what they're experiencing. And they're saying, well, yes, I want to be converted, I want to live my life more fully in listening to God, obedient to God, but this is getting in the way. And so Ignatius starts to give them advice, well, perhaps you ought to do this. Now, 16th century Spain, lots of problems around Europe in Christianity. This didn't go unnoticed. And so he gets a visit from the friendly Dominicans, who run an organization called the Inquisition, which is to guard the purity and the correctness of the way that people are talking about faith. This is actually a story that actually reflects rather well on the Inquisition, because they haul him in, they put him in prison, and they leave him there, and then they bring him out and they interrogate him, and they ask him what he's been saying. They ask him what he's been doing. They ask him for his notes. So they read through all the notes and they look at it and they say, okay, in fact, there's nothing wrong with what you've been saying. It's fine. So they set him free. But the problem is, what they don't want is for this rather uneducated and or rather unsystematically educated person wandering around and telling people serious questions about the Trinity or about what is sin, what's grave sin, what's less grave sin, and so on. So they tell him, well, you can't go around dressed like a monk. You've got to sort of dress in a very simple way. Ignatius has lots of encounters. At more or less each stage of his life, he meets the friendly Dominicans. And they have the same sort of conversations, each time with the same result, that they're saying, what you're saying is fine, but it's just we're a little bit worried that people are going to misunderstand it. So Ignatius eventually decides that he will go back to study, or he will start studying. Now, I've read a lot of his writing in the original Spanish which he wrote. It's appalling Spanish. I mean, I was learning Spanish and I was thinking, I can't really understand this. And I asked a Colombian Jesuit, and I said, this doesn't make any sense. He said, oh no, that's just Ignatius. He just writes very, very badly. There's a story of him he was very keen later in his life when he was in Rome of going and preaching in the public squares, and he would go and preach in Italian. And nobody understood what he was saying because his Italian was so bad. And so he'd take one of the young Jesuits along to help him with his preaching. And he said, Pedro, you will correct... No, Pedro was actually a Spaniard, but spoke beautiful Italian. Pedro, you will correct me as I preach. And apparently he didn't manage to even make one sentence because every single word was wrong. And a few weeks later, he went out again with Pedro to correct him, and Pedro said absolutely nothing. And he turned to Pedro and said, was that much better? There were no mistakes whatsoever. And he said, no, Father. It was so bad it wasn't worth correcting. But the life and enthusiasm of what he said was so great that it communicated what he was trying to say, even though the actual grammatical constructions of his words were just very, very poor. So Ignatius went back and started studying in these various places, and what he found, and I'll develop this a little bit more because it's relevant to all of us, what he found was that while he was studying, in order to be a priest authorized by the church to teach in the name of the Christian community, he was getting all sorts of beautiful and wonderful spiritual insights. And so he was thinking, oh yes, that's wonderful, this is amazing. I'd not realized how amazing and wonderful God was. And so he spent hours and hours in prayer. It was the result that he didn't sleep, and therefore he's falling asleep in his classes. He didn't have time to go over his classes because he's spending so much time in prayer. And of course, spending time in prayer is good. It's clearly what God wants, to be spending lots and lots of time in prayer. And eventually he sort of keeps going through this, and he's not doing very well in his studies, everything's going wrong, and so on. And eventually he goes and talks to different spiritual people, Dominicans, Franciscans, Benedictines, other people he knows. And they sort of say, well, actually, you need to cut back on your prayer. You're doing far too much prayer. These great, beautiful spiritual insights that you're getting are actually temptations in the form of good. Because what they're doing is, why are you studying? Why are any of you studying? You're studying because you want to gain knowledge so that you can use it for the betterment of our world, to the glory of God. That's why we study. And you're going to do greater things with what you have studied in the future than you can do now. That's why you're studying. It will be a distraction if you're thinking, I'm going to study so that I can get a really good job and earn lots and lots of money. That's probably not worth it. But in your studies, you will do much greater things as a result than if you just sort of say, I'm not going to bother to go to university, I'm just going to go and wander around talking about God. You will have a much bigger impact. The talk we heard about on the 11th of November, part of why it sounds quite impressive is you've got some very impressive academics who know a lot about things, and they're going to talk about their faith and the experience of their faith. It makes a difference. And Ignatius was finding himself tempted away from his studies to be thinking holy thoughts, to be daydreaming. And eventually he understood that these were genuinely temptations. And that he actually needed to say, I will give a certain amount of time to prayer, and the rest of the time, if I have holy thoughts, I'm just going to push them out of my mind, because they are distractions. That might sound quite shocking, but it's actually one of the things that he realizes, the necessity of structuring your prayer life. Now, this is also something that was long part of the tradition of the church. You have the monastic offices, you pray at certain times, and then you go and work in the fields, or looking after bees and making honey, or illuminating manuscripts, or whatever. You do other things in between the prayer. To work is to pray, as St. Benedict said. That's important as well. And so you always need to structure your prayer. It's no good just saying, I'll pray when I feel like it. Because either you're going to spend far too long praying, and it's going to be completely unstructured, and it's just going to be whatever I think of, or you're never going to get around to it. So one of Ignatius's insights is, when you're going to pray, you decide beforehand for how long you're going to pray. Where are you going to pray? Even in what posture are you going to pray? What passage of the Bible are you going to take on which to pray? So you don't spend your time flicking through the Bible and thinking, oh, that looks rather interesting. Oh, no, I'm a bit bored of that. Let's try another one. Flitting around like a butterfly, that's not going to get you very far. Ignatius' insight is you plan it out fairly rigorously and you just stick to it. So Ignatius says in the spiritual exercises, you might have set, I'm going to pray for an hour, and it might be really boring. Nothing happens, it's completely dry. So what's his advice when that happens? You stick at it. You just keep going. You pray for the hour. Perhaps pray for one extra minute to show that you have overcome the temptation. But it might be wonderful, it might just be absolutely amazing, and you just get full of insights. So what might you do? You stick to the hour. You don't extend it by 20 minutes, you don't extend it to 3 hours. You stick to the hour. Because that, you've decided that's what you're going to offer to God, and God is going to act in that space. But there's a huge importance, as you know from your studies, that you need to plan your studies. You can't just arrive at your desk and say, right, I'm going to do some work now. You need to have worked out what you're going to do before, and you need to do it systematically. It's the only way that you're going to succeed in getting and doing what you want to do. So Ignatius again has got to discern as a pilgrim whether he goes to try and do holy things or whether he's going to study. And this is a constant tension in his life, and indeed in the lives of Jesuits and Ignatian the religious orders that were founded after Ignatius in the same spirit. That I know that in my, and when I was doing my theological studies, I was far more interested in teaching catechism to the kids in on the in Saint-Denis than I was in actually sort of sitting there sort of reading through huge tomes on the history of dogma in the church. And I think that that was a temptation. It's important to just sort of get on and do those studies. So eventually he goes back and he learns grammar, Latin grammar, with the little kids, which is a great act of humility to be able to do that. One of the, and then he gets to Paris, and finally his grand idea starts to bear fruit. He manages to gather a group of friends around him who have the same idea. They want to pray with him. One of them was, he was sharing rooms with, was a Savoyard, a very pious lad who wanted to be a priest for all the best reasons and wanted to do great things. Another was a very ambitious Navarrese man who wanted to become a cleric in order to go up the clerical career ladder. And at first the Navarrese thought, who is this odd, limping, bizarre, Basque ex-nobleman, and wouldn't take him seriously. Eventually he starts to become more intrigued by him. Eventually Ignatius gathers a group around him and they decide that they will do something together for God. And they're all under Ignatius' influence. So what is the greatest possible thing that they might do for God? Of course, to go to Jerusalem and to spend their time in Jerusalem, in the place where Jesus had been. And so they gather, they're studying in Paris, they gather in the in a chapel on the hill of Montmartre, halfway up the hill, in the place where the first bishop of Paris, Saint-Denis, had been beheaded. And they celebrate Mass and they make a promise that within a year they will go to Jerusalem. And within three years they will go to Jerusalem. And if not, they'll be well-educated priests. They will go and offer themselves to the Pope and say, what do you want at the Pope? Because he can see what's happening in the church. He's got the best view. They'll go and offer themselves to the Pope and say, what do you want us to do? That was the only year, the year that they decided they would go, was the only year in several decades when there was no boat to Jerusalem whatsoever. And therefore they were not able to go to Jerusalem for the whole of that year. So instead they went to Rome and offered themselves to the Pope. And the Pope did something they weren't expecting, because they were expecting the Pope to say, wonderful, go off and do this. This is what needs doing. But instead he said, well, that's very good. Could two of you go to Germany? Could two of you go to Ireland? Could a couple of you go to India? Could some of you go to America? And so they were all being split up. So the decision then was to group together as a religious order. Again, I think that story is, Ignatius's first instinct is not correct. But what he allows it to be tested by experience so that he discovers what God is really asking of him. And sometimes God sort of puts a door in his way so that he can't go any further. So pious wish to go to Jerusalem, I think, I'm biased of course, but I think that what the Jesuits have done by not ever having got to Jerusalem is far more useful to the Christian community, to the church, than if we had gone to Jerusalem and stayed in the holy places. We'd have done wonderful, beautiful things there, but there is an enormous wealth of activity that's happened as a result of the Jesuits being prevented from going to Jerusalem. Such as St. Francis Xavier, one of Ignatius' companions, was sent precisely to India and basically set up or rediscovered that there were Christians in South India and has sort of strengthened the church, baptized some extraordinary number of people. I think there's a story of 5,000 people being baptized in one day. He just went around baptizing people all the time. Jesuits went around teaching catechism, doing science, doing all sorts of things as a result of this mission of saying, God is active in all of these things, we can do any of these things. So there's a huge amount of astronomy that has been done by Jesuits. For example, the discoverer of sunspots was a Jesuit astronomer. The person who categorized stars by their spectra was a Jesuit. That's in one area. Many of the dictionaries of languages that were unknown in Europe were compiled by Jesuit missionaries going and trying to work those things out. So there's a whole sense in Ignatian spirituality of that God can be found in all things. And Ignatius gives advice that you shouldn't just think that the holy things you're doing are when you're sitting in the chapel and praying. Because what he says is any prayer which isn't 24 hours out of 24, 7 days a week, is a short prayer. We should always be, in every single moment, seeking and finding and contemplating the presence of God. It's not just when you're sitting in the chapel. You can't possibly pray enough just by sitting in the chapel and praying. It's in all of those other things. So it could be when you're teaching. It could be when you're bandaging somebody, the wounds of somebody who is sick. It could be when you're listening to a talk. It could be when you're speaking to somebody who's homeless. All of these things can be moments where you genuinely encounter God. One of the things that the key prayer that Ignatius suggested, which I think is actually original to Ignatius, most of the things that we think of as Ignatian spirituality, the way that he organized things. He gathered a whole lot of experience into this tiny volume, which is quite practical to use. Whereas previously it had been in enormous monastic libraries and you wouldn't know where to look in them. The one thing I think that was original was something that he called the examen of consciousness. You might call it the review of the day. And it has 5 points that you can remember on your hand. And the first point is thanksgiving. And he suggests that you do this at noon and before going to bed each day as the most important prayer of the day. First of all, to take a moment to thank God for everything that you have received in the course of the day. Secondly, on your index finger, asking God to point out what was most important in the day. Because what you remember first might not be the most important moment. You ask God to show you, to shed light on those most important moments. And then the third moment, the longest finger, what stands out in the day, for good or for bad? Where have you actually encountered God? Or where have you rejected or resisted encountering God? Where have you been in great peace? Or where have you been annoyed, in turbulence, upset? Where have you been kind and generous and perfect Christian? And where have you been exactly the opposite? And you look through your day noticing all of those different things. And after that, there may well be a need for asking forgiveness. On the ring finger, the symbol, the ring, the finger on which we wear the sign of the promise we have made in marriage, or sometimes other sorts of promises. And you renew that promise by asking forgiveness. And for the married couples, it's always good, asking forgiveness is always a good way of renewing your marriage vows. And then the fifth little finger, which helps you to balance how you use your hand. If ever you've injured it or sprained it, you realize just how important it is and how much you use it. If you play a violin, it's what balances the bow. If you play tennis, it's what balances the racket. How do you rebalance your day in order that it's the way that God asks you to live? What do you need to change for the next day so that you live the next day the way that God is inviting you? So those 5 points form a simple review of the day that might take 15 minutes to do. And it's extraordinary as you do it, as you get accustomed to doing it, it becomes you become much more attentive to little things that you might not have noticed, but the way that God is speaking to you. That gives you a little bit of an idea of where this idea of Ignatian spirituality comes from, and a little bit of the ideas of what are the key ideas of the way that he prays. So thank you for listening. I think, and now we ask some other people to give their experiences of Ignatian spirituality. So maybe perhaps Christine might like to start. I don't know whether you want to get them to speak and then they can know, or whether you want to have your name out, whichever you. I will move the pile of books. Do you want the microphone?
The microphone in their hand.
Yeah.
Sure. Sorry. This is why I don't like radio mics. Yeah. How about that's good. Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks. So my name's Tom. I'm doing DPhil in mathematics at Balliol College. I've lost count the number of times I've done a week of guided prayer. Actually, my first experience of it was at my undergraduate university, the University of Warwick in the Chaplaincy, where a group of Jesuits from Loyola Hall came to give similar weeks to the one that Father Duchamp was describing at the beginning of this evening. And, gosh, difficult to know where to start, really. I guess my reflections would be that, well, maybe just to recap what actually goes on in this week of guided prayer. It's if you're going to do the whole week, you sign up with a prayer guide, someone who kind of offers spiritual direction, you could say, and you meet with them for 30 minutes each day, and you also commit to pray for about 30 minutes each day based on discussions with your prayer guide and suggestions that they have. And I guess picking up on what Father Duchamp was saying towards the end, or the impression he was giving of this advice of Ignatius, it is intensely practical. It is not a time for theorizing about God, about prayer. It's about where you are right here, right now in your life, and giving you sort of tools from, I guess, this wisdom that has now been developed over the last few centuries for being able to see God's action, his voice in your life. And my own experience is I've entered into the week, well, I've in sort of broadly two different frames of mind. Sometimes I've had a specific issue or something which I want about in life or in prayer that I wanted to talk about, and that has been, it's typically been fruitful. And the more I've been able to be honest with my prayer guide, you know, the more fruitful that's been. But I think the times that have stuck out more was when I just signed up and said, you know, hey, what the hey, let's give it a go and see what happens. Without any sort of prior expectations. And my reflection, I think, on Ignatian spirituality, I guess, in general, would be that a light hold of expectations and hopes, or maybe even goals, I think is a really helpful ingredient to approaching this way of prayer. it's so easy to kind of, and I think for people, for students who, you know, spend a lot of time in their head, it's very easy to sort of very subtly sort of get thinking in ways of, you know, oh, well, I kind of hope actually that God is, you know, pointing me in this direction, or, oh, that sounds nice. Yeah, that must be it. No, that's definitely it. And just to go down those sorts of, yeah, routes of prior expectation, but trying to hold those lightly can often result in very surprising things happening in this sort of prayer. And the things that stick out most, as I say, are the times when I've entered into it without expectations, and sometimes the movements in prayer that I've experienced have been very unexpected and unmanufactured. And I think that's, well, that's something that sort of sticks out as I reflect on it, actually. But yeah, I guess intensely practical as well, as I said, that's what I would close off with.
Thanks.
Great. My name's Christine. I'm a DPhil in politics here. I'm also a member of the Christian Life Community, which is the lay Ignatian community. So like Father Duchesne said, St. Ignatius founded the Jesuits, and there are also a lot of women religious who follow the spirituality of St. Ignatius. And there's also a community that of lay people who are not committed in one way or the other to religious life, who live kind of married life or single life, who follow this kind of spirituality. I've done 2 weeks of guided prayer. I did the first one a couple of years ago, and last year I was away on an exchange term in the States, but I was so sad to be missing out on it, I managed to convince my spiritual guide to do it over Skype with me. So I am a big fan and have been really helped by it. And I think Tom's really explained to us kind of the experience of actually doing the week of guided prayer, and I'm going to talk very briefly, I think more abstractly, about what's kind of drawn me to Ignatian spirituality and some of the things that I found kind of odd and tricky at first, but have been really fruitful. So I think the first thing that really drew me to Ignatian spirituality were some of the people that I met. I had this opportunity, I spent 2 weeks in Spain with a lot of Ignatian people, and they really struck me as the kind of Christian I wanted to be. And I think what it is about it was that they were people who were free, who were comfortable in their own skins. So they managed to hold both kind of the joy and hope and the love of God, and also to be people who were passionate about things about justice, engaged and kind of troubled by things that were going on in the world around them, but managing to maintain hope and clearly a strong love of God. And also people who were clearly very talented and intelligent, but very humble, very clear that even though they were very knowledgeable, they'd kind of spent a long time learning how to live their faith, that they were still on that journey and that they didn't have all the clear answers to everything. It was about trying to discern their life, to reflect each day on how they'd lived their life, where God was in their life, and to grow from that. And I just found that a really kind of encouraging type of person, and thought that's the kind of person I want to be. And I think kind of related to that, the second thing I thought I'd like to share was Ignatian spirituality teaches us not only that we should find God in everything, in our everyday life and everything around us, but importantly that we are created by God, and so one of the key ways we can come to know God is by reflecting on who we are and trying to become the best version of ourselves. That's both the best way, I think, to come to understand and know God better, and also how to best serve God and live a life that loves God. And so I think that's been that experience of dedicating our time to coming to know like who I am has been very worthwhile. So then the third thing I was going to say is about some of the things I found a bit difficult. So Father Duchesne's described a bit briefly about imaginative prayer, for example. And a lot of, you know, there's this manual that St. Ignatius has written that's going to help us. It's very small, very practical. And I think I found it difficult at first to think that I needed to learn how to pray. I needed to kind of gather together these tools in order to be able to pray and know what God was saying to me. Like, surely what I want to say to God, I can just say, and if God wants to tell me something, he can do that. And I think that was a mistake, and being kind of like Tom mentioned, open to the fact that there are things that I could learn. And I think fundamentally the idea that maybe I'm fine with telling God what I want and what I need, but I needed to have some help in how to listen to God and how to find God in my everyday life, how to find what God was telling me in my time of prayer. And so it has been exceptionally helpful, particularly to build relationships with somebody like a spiritual guide, somebody who's not going to tell you, oh, you should do X or Y, but will listen to what you've experienced and kind of ask you questions and walk alongside you in a way that helps you to notice things that you can't on your own. And also to have these tools of prayer that help you to more clearly see where God is in your life, to kind of hone your perception, to teach you to ask the right questions. And I think having those tools have really helped me along that first thing that I said, the idea of coming to know myself better and to live a life that I kind of feel is more in line with the best version of who I can be. And I think that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. Okay, so just a chance for to ask questions, if you have questions of Father Duchon or any of our panelists. By the way, thank you guys both for sharing that. We appreciate that. So fire your hand up and I'll find you. Oh, sure. And then, second one.
I was going to ask if any of you have any words to say if someone found it very difficult to pray or had never prayed before or didn't know what to say, whether St. Ignatius has any insights as to where you should start.
You can add in the So I think, like we've kind of mentioned a little bit, one of the key ideas is being open. And also what St. Ignatius, I think the key piece of advice will be, he kind of talks about what we desire and says, if we can't find it in ourselves to desire what we think we should be, we should ask God to help us to want to desire that. And I think the same thing would apply with prayer, that what St. Ignatius would say, or what I would say, is that if you're finding it difficult to pray, to ask for the kind of desire to spend time with God, the desire to be in God's presence. People have recommended before, I've heard, like, you know, just to spend 5 days each day in silence at the beginning of it to ask for that kind of desire to pray more and to feel God's presence, and kind of both by kind of asking for the desire and trying and asking to be open to developing that one.
I think the only thing I would add is the great genius of Ignatius is actually giving you a manual. He basically tells you what to do, and it creates a space, which I often describe as being sort of, it's like he creates a sort of IKEA flat-pack chapel. And he sort of says, now do this, and then you sort of do that, and then, and somehow it creates the space. Even though you sort of think, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm sure you've built bookcases and desks and chairs and whatever from IKEA. Yeah? And you have, I'm no carpenter, and I'm no plumber either, and there are stories about my attempts at plumbing. But, I had no idea how to do those things, but following those instructions from IKEA, it's actually quite easy to put together something, and it creates a space in which you can pray. So, and I think part of the other really important thing is that we tend to think of, what do I need to do to pray? And actually, I think it's the wrong question. The question is, how do I need to be in order to listen to what God is trying to say to me? And it's really about creating a space in which you can just sort of sit there and enter into a conversation with God. And God will speak. And
quite astonishing, and I've accompanied people often to say, I had no idea how to do this, what do I do? And gradually they just sort of find a way, and they have really deep, powerful experiences of prayer in the most unlikely of circumstances. So I would say, try it.
I just have a question about the prayer, asking the Lord to tell you, you know, who you are and what you want to do, day after day after day after day. Then my question is, do you pray for other people? Do you gather in a group and pray together, or just individual every day?
Are you asking me
particularly? Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a combination of both of those things. So part of, I think, what's central is our personal relationship with God. And the community which I belong to gathers together and shares with each other where God is in our lives. And in that act of sharing, we kind of learn from each other and learn about ourselves as well. And then fundamentally as well, I think we belong to a wider community and we attend church services and we pray for others. And we kind of spend time also, you know, reflecting on how we can, I think one of the products of a deep relationship with God is seeking to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And so one spends time kind of trying to discern how you can best act towards others and best serve God's kingdom in that way. I think that those are the two other regarding parts of it.
Yeah.
Quick question, do we need the mic? Can everyone hear, or how is that? It's fine? Okay, then it'll be easier for you to turn it off. Ken.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. Thank you for the hand. That's a great takeaway. We like that one. When I was growing up, my mother prayed regularly using the rosary. And what you've described seems to me to be the polar opposite of that. And I wonder theologically how we square that circle.
I would say that rosary is exactly the same thing. It creates a space in order to contemplate the mysteries of the life of Christ. Somebody, I was given the exercise over the summer, and somebody said, Ignatius has a huge devotion to the Mother of God. How come he never mentions the rosary? I'd actually never thought of the question. And I started thinking about it, and I realized that actually the devotion to the rosaries comes slightly, the increase comes slightly after the time of Ignatius. But basically what the rosary does is, it says, this is how to occupy the busyness of your mind. You say these prayers. You say the Our Father, ten Hail Marys, and the Glory Be. That's like, you say 150 Hail Marys, that's like saying the monastic office of 150 Psalms. So it occupies a certain part of your mind, and then while you're saying that Our Father, ten Hail Marys, Glory Be, you contemplate a scene from the life of Christ, which is exactly what Ignatius is encouraging you to do. It's just giving you a different way of doing that, and different people need different ways into it. I would also say there are different moments you need different sorts of prayer, and I think for most people, it's impractical to pray the Divine Office. It comes in the Catholic Church, it comes in three large volumes, which are really very difficult to carry around. It's now available on your telephone, which is really helpful, because when I need to pray it, I can do that. But the rosary, I can carry it in my back pocket, and I'm sitting in the bus, I'm sitting on the bus, and I can contemplate a scene from the life of Christ. They're the 20 key scenes from the life of Christ. And there I am in prayer, sitting at the bus stop, sitting on the train, walking along the road, whatever. It's a very practical, simple way of entering into prayer. So I would never, never, ever discourage people from praying the rosary. What I think sometimes the way that the rosary has been prayed has not always been helpful. Because sometimes it can just be sort of rushing through the saying of prayers. But the point is always, it's about contemplating the life of Christ. And that's what prayer is. Or part of it. It's entering into conversation with God is what prayer is. and that comes through the contemplation of the life of Christ.
Yeah, you. Thanks for your presentation. I did some imaginative praying over the summer, which I found really helpful. But I had a kind of question about how can we kind of interpret what's going on in the story. For instance, you might read secular psychology, and someone who's advising you to do cognitive behavioral therapy might advise you to imagine yourself in certain circumstances, right? So rather than just telling yourself, oh, you know, I can be more assertive in social situations, you might actually picture yourself going to an event and, you know, entering with some swagger, etc. And that might actually genuinely impact your ability to do things. And I certainly found imaginative prayer was really helpful, you know, picturing God tangibly loving me, and it was really powerful. I guess probably because I'm eternally a skeptic of religious experience, like I was like, this is great, but I'm just like doing psychology basically, like I'm not really encountering the spirit. But is there any reason why, like, do you think that we have good grounds for interpreting it as more than a kind of purely mental exercise, but also think that, you know, the Holy Spirit or something is putting some causal impetus into what's going on? Like, is there something else going on besides self-play? Does that make sense?
I give three parts of response. One would be theological, one would be historical. We're talking about Christians.
Yeah.
Christians believe that God created everything that is, and that God became part of that creation, became human. That means that everything can be a way towards God. Key insight in relation to spirituality. That means that your imagination, your psychology, all of that can be a tool leading you towards God. Second point, historically, as I mentioned, Jesuits have been in all sorts of fields, Ignatian religious, and people inspired by Ignatian spirituality have been in all sorts of fields. It would not surprise, I don't know the history of this, but it would not surprise me at all if the sort of exercises you're talking about came from people who've done the spiritual exercises. And that's where they started to introduce that as another technique. There are certainly, I know there are Jesuits involved in all sorts of areas of psychology and psychiatry. So it could well be that they've sort of borrowed the technique to use something else. And I think finally, that it's something of all of those, there's something about ordering your whole life towards God and then verifying it. And part of the use of having somebody accompanying you in prayer and referring back to the community of the church is that you say, I sort of say, I think God has told me to do this. And I go and ask Christine, my guide, and I say, so in my prayer this happened. And then Christine points out to me various other aspects of it, where I realize actually that it could be God speaking, or it could be a complete distraction. And I've seen that happening in myself and in other people that I've accompanied. And sometimes there's a sort of verification process of going back to the community. So if what I imagine in contemplating gospel scene is something that is completely contradictory to the whole of the Bible, I can simply sort of say, well, actually, that's not coming from God. Yeah? And by contradictory, I don't mean it's something that doesn't happen already in the Bible. Yeah? So you might be imagining gospel scene, and as you're praying the scene, Jesus turns to you and says, so, how are you feeling about this? Okay? That doesn't quite happen that way in the Gospels. But it's not something that contradicts what Jesus does as he walks around and he meets people. Yeah? If what comes up in your prayer is that Jesus turns around to you and picks up a huge stick and bashes you over the head, that is pretty much contrary to everything that's in the Bible. So you can say, that's something that's coming from somewhere else. there. So I think there's something that we ourselves can recognize what might be extraneous. A guide helps us to recognize that, and that's part of the discernment of spirit that when Ignatius was sort of balancing up whether to follow the Infanta of Spain and to court her, or whether to be a pilgrim to Jerusalem. It was clearly, he wasn't quite being called to be a pilgrim to Jerusalem, but it was more on the side of being a pilgrim to Jerusalem than courting the Queen of Spain. And therefore, there's this process of discernment of spirit, and it's useful to be testing that. And there's no guarantee that things that pop into your head are going to all be perfect and all be ready-made, but you keep on testing it and verifying it to make sure, and continually asking God, and what are you asking me to do? How are you leading me forward? And within a particular vocation, within a particular major decision, there will be little decisions to be made. When I, for example, it took me a long time to reconcile myself to the idea of being a Jesuit. Finally I did. And the one thing I was absolutely certain I didn't want to do, and I would never ever do, would be to work in a school and to teach. And I thought it was a complete waste of time. And then, as happens to Jesuits, my provincial said, I want you to go and work in a school, I want you to teach. And actually, it was great fun. I mean, it was a really great ministry, a great way of engaging young people in encountering God. And I'm very glad that I did it, and I really enjoyed it. And I think I did some good in doing it. So sometimes within the major invitation that God is giving, there is something that we haven't quite got right that needs to be corrected, like my resistance for the possibility of working in a school.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. I just wondered, in the guidelines that Ignatius gives towards prayer, is there any reference to Jesus' guidelines in the Sermon on the Mount?
It's basically a lot of it. At the time that Ignatius sort of compiled this, he couldn't read Latin, and therefore he hadn't actually read the Bible. So he got the scenes, and so he knew what it was. But in the text of the exercises, there are subsequently added references to scripture. So basically, this is a way of entering into scripture and praying.
Specific to the sermon, because Jesus teaches us a sort of way to pray, doesn't he, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6. Is there specific to that one?
Well, we're praying those scenes, and this is based on Christian experience over 1500 years, starting from the Gospels, using the Desert Fathers, using monastic practices in order to build to distill it down into that. So yes, but I wouldn't say the experience is explicit and sort of say that's simply how you do it. But basically, I don't think anybody who's done Ignatian prayer would say yes, this is contrary to what I'm reading in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah, I was just going to ask a question about the guidance thing, really. So in your experience, you know, it seems like a big part of it is being able to trust another. And in the culture that we live in, a lot of what we do, we value a sort of a self-autonomy. And that, in relationship to what it looks like to be part of a community, sometimes can have tensions. Have you found, and perhaps you guys who've been engaged in it as well, have you found that you have to go over a particular hurdle, or you have to help people time and time again through a particular hurdle of some kind to get over themselves in some way, that actually to trust you and say, what do you think, and actually allow your life to be in part as it could and should be in a sense of a community in someone else's hands as much as your own? There's quite a countercultural move in all of that, which we're not necessarily okay with, because we think that we've lost something, or, you know, you're probably going to abuse that. If I give you control, you'll manipulate me. How do you find that? Because it sounds like it's the right way forward, to be entrusting of others. But what do you find is kind of perhaps the first hurdle to overcome?
If I can talk from my experience just of doing these weeks of guided prayer, I think the first step is
submitting to the advice of another person, actually. And I imagine the way I see it, whenever there's an experience which has room, you know, to actually grow us and nurture us, there's a certain sense that you have to be taken along the hand and kind of do what, kind of follow a teacher, master, until, well, to get yourself going. And there's a certain, yeah, there's a certain sacrifice of sort of autonomy and figuring it out all yourself, which is actually, can also be quite liberating, actually. So I think that first step is simply listen, after trying to share your experiences, listening to suggestions from another, probably, you know, wiser or more experienced person, and to go with that, actually.
But do you find this, you've overcome it? Because it's a bit like saying, you know, I'm the kind of person that I'd like to go on a bungee jump, yet when I'm there, I'm confronted with actually, there's actually a massive drop here. You see what I mean? There are types of people that will go on a bungee jump, and there are types of people who definitely wouldn't even consider it. And this has got something of that quality in some ways. I'm not suggesting you necessarily bungee jump when you pray, but do you know what I'm saying? There's something of, you have to be minded in that space already. You don't just go, oh yeah, I think I'll trust someone else. You have, do you see what I mean? And actually confronted with it, you might want to reject and push back and say, actually, thanks, but I think I can decide for myself.
I'm thinking in the context of sort of Ignatian contemplation, trying to imagine a moment of what God might be saying to me, and sometimes actually I find I resist that, and that it's a very, it's almost like a black box, and I shy away from it, the moment comes, and I'm like, no, I'll retreat back, I think. And I almost just want to say, those with a generous heart trying to do the best they can, you know, will be received and loved, and that will be noticed, and that it's a gradual bit by bit process, actually, but sometimes it's really hard, and there can be all sorts of things that you have to, that are going on under the surface, that can make trusting either God in prayer or just another person through trying to relate your experiences. It just takes time. It's a bit gradual process, I suppose. I can't get any more concrete than that.
Could I add on to that? I think that's just the thing. I think sometimes you find in these kind of retreat contexts, it'll take somebody the whole week to kind of spit out what they really need to say, because often it is really difficult to say the thing that's kind of really weighing on you. And that's fine, right? You don't have to, you have to build that relationship over time. And in my personal experience, I think just broadly speaking about like trusting people and getting into it, like I found myself in a very vulnerable position where it was kind of, I didn't have the strength to like, you know, keep it together anymore, and so I was willing to talk to somebody and to build relationships of trust. That's obviously not going to be how it is for everybody. So I can really understand your point. Like, I think that was actually a really helpful thing for me, because I would have found it very difficult otherwise, I think. And in my experience of like building up groups that are about like sharing, so what these groups are sharing of where God is in our lives. And it's not a case of people responding to that and saying, oh, well, that's interesting, maybe you should do this or maybe you should do that. It's like about the space of sharing. It's about committing to the fact that when we share with each other, we kind of learn from each other and we learn about ourselves. And I found the way that you can help people to kind of overcome the barrier is by being the person who's willing to share. So I'm often in a group that's starting out, and you kind of share too much. You know, you kind of like overshare in the context of that group, because you've got to kind of start it out and be the person who's willing to be vulnerable. And people see the value of that, and they respect it, and they can kind of see that, you know, recognize themselves in you, you know, the way in which you're struggling or hoping or X or Y. And I think that really does encourage people. Kind of one person does it in the group, then another does, and slowly people start to feel that that space is safe, because they never hear anybody talking about what's happened outside of the group, and they just realize that everybody's seeing that as a safe space. And I think that's true of individual direction as well. Like over time, you get to know the kind of people who direct, you get to see the relationships that happen between people, and you can see it in like a safe space for people.
I think there's something of, it's the difficulty is really handing oneself over to God. The people accompanying, they are trained and sifted. They're sort of redirected to perhaps other things that they might do than accompanying people in retreats. But it takes time to build up the relationship. And I think Christine described it really, really well. That it's a gradual process. But a lot of it is, fundamentally, we don't change completely. We don't become somebody else, and therefore my weaknesses before God are the same weaknesses that I had before. They change. They might be modified. They might be brought under control. But the issues are still going to be the same thing. I suppose the astonishing thing in Christianity is that God can cope with that. God can work with that. Even though, you have Paul or Ignatius, who I think actually remains pretty vain throughout his life, but his vanity is redirected. His ambition is redirected to the glory of God rather than to the glory of Ignatius. And I think that's what's the amazing thing in Christianity. That you don't have to become perfect before you follow Christ. Gradually you're perfected, but it takes an entire lifetime.
There's one more question. So if one's extending this from, say, doing it for a week for a retreat, try it out, to a rationale for your general life when you come to pray, you've got the example of religious people who take vows and are under obedience. If you're applying this to a lay life, would it be a matter of putting accountability, or structures of accountability as a key part of all you need to run? And if so, how do you, in an order, you have a superior and your superior is your superior, full stop. But if in lay life, you have to choose a superior, or you have to choose a spiritual director, that's difficult, because you don't know who should you trust. So therefore, that's the question. Who should we trust in terms of accountability figures and people that can go to a spiritual director sometimes?
I mean, I would say it's certainly in religious orders, the superior and the spiritual director are distinct people. I have a superior who's given to me because of where I live, which community I belong to, and I have a spiritual director who, in consultation with the superior and others, I have chosen. And they're quite distinct roles. Sometimes I might say the same things to them, but the way that we use those things are different. I think for a lay person, the superior is, in a sense, the one with whom I've promised my life. So quite possibly, it's actually the one's spouse, the circumstances of one's life, one's children, and so on. The people you're committed to in all sorts of ways, that in many ways shape those decisions about what you might do. In terms of spiritual direction, it's a process of helping you to reflect on your life. It isn't about telling you what to do. And sometimes I've accompanied people, and it was clear to me what I thought they should do, but that wasn't what they were choosing to do. And depending on if it's a formal spiritual direction relationship, we're not supposed to tell people, no, complete mistake there, you shouldn't do that. You might try and help them see that, but you wouldn't sort of say, you can't do that. Yeah? In other circumstances, in a pastoral role, I might well do that to somebody, because if I think it's going to help them. But as a spiritual director, I wouldn't.
It's for them, it's to help them to discover what God is. The spiritual director or the person accompanying is there to help them to hear what God is saying to them. And Ignatius really sort of says, more or less says, you should, the person giving the exercise should sort of step back to allow the creature to encounter the creator, to hear what the creator is saying to the creature, and not to sort of interfere. And that, I think that's what we try to do. Of course, we're flawed. And I always know best, and I always tell people how they can best live their lives. So sometimes I get in the way, but the idea is of not getting in the way.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is just to stress that a spiritual director is not kind of the same kind of relationship that you might find in these other kind of accountability kind of partners or groups that you might find. So your spiritual director is not there to hold you accountable to what you said you would do or what some objective standard is. They're there to listen to you, to give you a space to talk about your spiritual experience of God and to kind of nudge you. I mean, the quick kind of questions would be like, so what do you think God's saying to you in that thing? Or like, have you thought about this? It's never like, oh well, like, you know, so you should do X, or oh, Christine, I saw you the other day doing such and such, like, we need to talk about that. It's kind of a completely different realm. It is really just a realm to be sharing about our prayer life and our kind of journey with God. And in terms of how one might live it more fully as a layperson, you don't have this kind of superior who might direct you in some way or other, or perhaps hold you accountable in the way you kind of are leaning towards. It's more about building community. So you have small group communities, and you have a way of prayer and somebody to accompany you. So it's more about, I guess, a way of prayer, a way of viewing how God is in your life, and a way, which we haven't spoken about as much, but a way of how we make decisions, like how we try to see God in the way in which we kind of decide how we do what's right for us, as opposed to what is just in itself a good thing. So it's much less structured, I guess, being an Ignatian, like, you know, a person who follows Ignatian spirituality. But it can be very formative to how you live your relationship.
Great. Any last questions? Last question. Okay, well, thank you guys so much. Thanks for speaking, Father Dushan, and for sharing your experience.